From KLCC Studios, this is Oregon on the Record.
I'm Michael Dunn. We're awash in grocery stores, restaurants, convenience stores, and a myriad other options to get food in our community. And while that creates massive convenience and opportunity to feed our bellies, few of us ever really contemplate the idea of being truly intentional in obtaining the calories that we need. Today on the show, you'll meet a person who is more than intentional. He's a person who is actively foraging for all of his food and medicine in nature. His name is Robin Greenfield, and he roams the wilderness areas, parks, open spaces, and even roadsides to obtain all that he needs to consume. It's extreme, yes, but his intention is to draw attention to our unhealthy corporate food system and to espouse a simpler way. Then, at the end of the show, we'll get an update on the fence at the federal court building. This morning, I had cereal with milk and a banana, and obtaining those three elements was as easy as opening my fridge and pantry. My actions were far, far removed from my hunter-gatherer ancestors. Today on the show, however, you'll meet a man who's as close to that lifestyle as one can get in our modern society. His story is next. Robin Greenfield, an activist and social reformer, thanks so much for coming in and talking to us.
It's wonderful to be in Eugene.
Yeah, you know, you're foraging 100% of your food and medicine for 1 year. Tell us how you're doing it.
Sure, yeah. Today is day 250 of a year without grocery stores or restaurants or even a garden. Nature is my garden, my pantry, and my pharmacy. And how am I doing it? Well, I'm connecting with a lot of the information that we've lost connection with. But the truth is that food and medicine is growing freely and abundantly all around us. It's right outside our doors, in our churchyards, our schoolyards, our public parks, our, the roadsides, everywhere. And so I'm connecting with that.
Yeah. How did you learn, or maybe it's an ongoing process, of what foods are edible and what foods aren't?
Yes. I would say, ultimately, I learned one plant at a time. That's the way that I take most everything I'm trying to accomplish in life, with one practical step at a time. And it was about 10 years ago that I really started foraging, 15 years ago that I started questioning the global industrial food system. And so just one plant at a time, learning what I need to know in order to break free from the grocery store and be able to meet my needs in a way that, what I would say is, by existing in a relationship with the earth and the plants and animals.
Here's a simple question. Do you get enough calories doing what you're doing?
Yeah, well, I'm 250 days in. I'm touring all over the country as I'm doing this, and I'm here, you know, I feel my body, I'm here. The grocery stores, the restaurants, I don't remember what they're like, and I'm getting enough food.
Okay. I've heard other people talk about this sort of concept of food as medicine. Talk about that in the way that you see it.
Yes, absolutely. Every single food that I eat is medicine for me, whether it's the wild rice, the venison, the fish, the berries, the apples, the plums, the pears, or, you know, my herbal teas like the mint. And so everything that I take in, my food is my medicine, and also my medicine is my food. So much of what people would take particularly as a medicine is also a food. So to put it really simply, the way that we live today, a lot of people need to take medicine because our food is harming us. And by eating whole natural foods from the earth and selecting what works well for me, it's all a medicine. Preventative healthcare is another way that I put it.
Obviously, foraging is a very ancient form of food intake that humans done for millennia, but we probably have lost that ability. How hard was it for you to sort of connect with that?
You know, it wasn't too hard for me. I'm grateful that I grew up in, I actually grew up in a small town called Ashland in northern Wisconsin.
Okay.
And one note I want to say is I was maybe conceived right here in Eugene.
Okay.
My mom and dad met in Eugene in 1985. And it's just so nice to be here connecting with the people of Eugene.
Sure.
But I grew up where it was normal to pick berries, like for a lot of Argonians, you know, it's normal to do some of this. And so I had never completely lost connection.
Okay.
So for me, it was relatively natural to reconnect with what we've always known deep inside.
Okay. what are some of the challenges or risks? For example, Oregon is very well known as we have a lot of wild mushrooms. And obviously they're great food, but of course there are some mushrooms that can be incredibly toxic. Have you had any issues where maybe you ate something and it had an adverse effect? Or is it a challenge to be seen on the side of the road or maybe in a park getting food like you do?
Well, I'm really happy to say that we live in a time when there's no reason to die from foraging. There's no good reason. And there's really no reason to get sick from foraging. The knowledge is there. We have it in books, you know, on websites. There's hundreds of knowledgeable foragers that are out there sharing this information. So I don't get sick from foraging because I only eat something if I'm certain that I can eat it.
Okay.
Now, I have made some mistakes.
Okay.
For example, just recently I've learned about soap root, which grows in Northern California and Oregon. It's a wonderful staple calorie food, but it has to be prepared right, and our society doesn't have that knowledge.
Okay.
Well, it has saponins in it, and I didn't cook it right, and I had the worst gas of my entire life. So sometimes I make some mistakes, but nothing that's going to kill you or anything like that. And we've all had gas from eating too much at the buffet or something like that too.
Sure. If you're just joining us, we're talking to Robin Greenfield. He is an activist and social reformer and forager for a year. So obviously all of us have our favorite foods. Do you have like a staple that you absolutely love that you forage for that's widely available to you?
Well, so many plants come to mind for me, but I would say the abundance of apples that are growing in the fall and being able to turn them into applesauce that's easy on the stomach. Mm-hmm. It's a nice treat to be able to have all winter, spring and summer until the apples come back. And then, of course, wild rice. That's my staple calorie that I harvest in northern Wisconsin where I'm from. So those would be two that come to mind.
Yeah. Is there, I think you had mentioned earlier, like venison and fish. I mean, how do you, I assume then you're not a vegetarian. So how do you forage for animals?
Yes. Well, I fish. I've been fishing since I was about 6 years old. So that's a practice, the skill that I have. Mm-hmm. And I fish with a fishing pole. Also do some netting for smelt and whitefish. And then as far as deer go, I would hunt, but I haven't hunted yet because in Wisconsin, 20,000 deer are killed by cars per year. So I harvest what some people call roadkill.
Okay.
And I say a deer that was hit by a car.
Okay. I am wondering about, was there a moment when you made this decision? And when you made this decision, was it, I want to do this to celebrate foraging, or was it also, I want to see if it can be done?
Yeah, well, I've been doing immersive activism campaigns for about 13 years now. Mm-hmm. And the idea is always two parts. One, it's for me to explore something that I'm deeply passionate about. And two, to bring others along on a journey where they're going to get to learn, to question the unquestioned societal norms, and to critically think. Mm-hmm. So last year I was in California. I had just finished my walk from Canada to Los Angeles, where I'd walked down the Oregon coast. And I asked myself, what do I want to do more than anything in the world? And it just came so clearly to me that I wanted to make this attempt of foraging 100% of my food as a way of deepening my connection and my relationship with the earth, and as a way of doing something that I thought would really reach a lot of people in a meaningful way.
Mm-hmm. Concern about our modern agriculture and making us sick. Talk about that in terms of what you've studied, what you've learned, because obviously often there are media reports about, you know, heavily processed foods, that sort of thing. Talk about it from your lens, very down to earth, if you will.
Yes, I've been involved in food, of course, my entire life, but as far as questioning our food system deeply since 2011, and a lot of my awakening came from documentaries like Food Inc. and authors like Michael Pollan, The Omnivore's Dilemma. Mm-hmm. And so I really started to question our food system, which is sold to us as normal. But the reality of the matter is that right now we're going through the sixth extinction. And it is human driven, and a big part of it is our global industrial food system. The fact of the matter is what's sold to us as normal is driving ourselves to a potential extinction. And that's the way things are going with this food system. Some people say things like, well, can the whole world forage? And first you have to ask, can the whole world eat from the global industrial food system? The answer is no. Mm-hmm. We're running out of time in that regard. So for me, it's very clear that we need to do things differently if we want to have an earth that truly serves the people. Whether or not we as a humanity ever overcome this issue that we're in, this, you know, potential demise, is important, yet doesn't affect the fact that I'm going to keep doing this one way or the other because life matters. I value life. I value the life of all the plants, the animals, and fellow humans we share this home with. And so I'm going to eat in a way that rather than taking a bite out of the planet with every bite I take, that I'm actually doing my best to regenerate this planet.
I'm glad you brought up Michael Pollan. Having read that book, Omnivore's Dilemma, he brought up a good point about scale and sustainability, because his argument was, yeah, it may not be possible with 8 billion people on the planet to do something like you're doing, but he also brought up the point that it is unsustainable the way that our modern agriculture is headed. Do you see a middle ground that is accessible to most people?
Yeah, absolutely. So I do take on extreme projects, but they're not designed for anybody else to do exactly what I'm doing. And just one note on that, the only reason that what I'm doing is extreme is because it's being compared to one of the most extreme societies that's ever existed. That is us. But my message is, let's do what we can as individuals, as communities, in order to be the change that we wish to see in the world. So what I encourage people to do, go to the local farmers market, get as much of our food as possible from local food systems, grow some of our own food, forage some of our own food, turn our yards into gardens, and connect with our local community, know where our food is coming from, and make it a deeply meaningful part of our lives. One of the big ones for me is eating whole foods. So I don't have any diet of any sort, but just not ultra processed foods, just real whole foods. And for me, for people that are, you know, buying food, the food co-op to me is just one of the wonderful places to build a diet around, especially the bulk section of the food co-op where we can buy our stuff without all the packaging.
In learning about you, I see you talk about reconnection with the earth. Tell people what that means to you.
Well, I think that the greatest threat that we have today as a humanity is the belief that we're separate. The belief that we're separate from the earth, the belief that we're separate from the plants and animals, and the belief that we're separate from each other, our global humanity and our next door neighbors. I think one of the most important things we can do is dissolve this illusion of separateness in which we have been indoctrinated into, and remember that we are of this earth. We're from this earth. We're part of this earth. We're not a cancer upon this earth. We belong here. This is our home. So my whole life is designed around reconnecting to all the life that is around. And as we are aware of the life that we share this home with, then we can actually protect, we can become stewards. So one step at a time, breaking free from this disconnection and this separateness and being more connected. And this is not about giving up, because as we reconnect, it's a life of joy and meaning and purpose, the basic human needs that every single one of us are seeking.
I would imagine there have been times when you're out foraging, you might come across people and they may say, what the heck are you doing? Talk about some of those conversations, because I imagine people are like, well, that's unusual. What is that like?
Yeah, I like to forage by the side of the road and have all these cars passing by and seeing, look, a real human being outside harvesting their food. So it's definitely, one thing I love about foraging is it does go against a lot of the societal norms. There's a lot of people think that you would only forage if you didn't have money to go to the grocery store. And then in the cities, I can't tell you the number of times where I'm eating the berries that are growing right outside people's doors on the sidewalk, and they're like, those are poisonous. And I say, well, I've been eating them for many years. So that's a big thing for me, is just helping people to see that right outside their door, the things they've been taught to fear are actually wonderful foods and medicines.
Yeah. Any concerns when you're, again, foraging on the side of the road? Obviously, one of the other big situations with our industrial farming is pesticides and those sorts of things. How do you sort of deal with that?
Yeah, I do have concerns around that, yes. And I have my sort of balance that I go back and forth on. For anybody who's particularly concerned about that, we're all free human beings and we have to make our own decisions. My encouragement to people would be start in the areas where you know aren't sprayed. That could be your own front yard or backyard or a friend's place, you know, land that you know someone that has that doesn't spray. You can talk to the city and find out what their practices are and forage in the places where they're not sprayed. Personally, I take a little bit more of a... I eat a lot of my food does come from the roadside.
Okay.
As I'm traveling, mm-hmm. I'll see an apple tree that's, you know, at the edge of the highway, and I'll harvest myself some apples. So I'm a little less careful in that regard than the average person. And the reason that's the case for me is that I'm just not willing to live in fear of the earth. And if that ends up killing me, I'll have lived a good life as long as I'm here. So I do take some risks in that regard. And again, we each have to make our own decisions. Just like we make our decisions of whether we buy organic or not,
sure.
We can decide what we do when it comes to foraging.
An entire year, there are four seasons. Is your foraging seasonal as well?
Yeah, the big idea of me doing this year of foraging is that every day this forces me to have a connection with the land. I can't just go to the grocery store and buy whatever I want. I have a planning book, and I know when things are going to be in season, and so I'm often planning months in advance for what I'm going to eat. It's not strenuous, but I know, like, all right, when I get to eat apples again, not going to be until August.
Mm-hmm.
So I have to store away enough applesauce for that. So I eat a combination of very seasonal, whatever's available right now, and then also what I'm able to harvest that's abundant, and then store that in order to be able to eat that out of the season as well.
Okay. He's Robin Greenfield, an activist and social reformer, foraging for a year. Great to talk to you. Thanks so much.
Very nice to be here with you.
Now let's check in with KLCC's Nathan Wilk about a ruling on the fence erected at the Eugene Federal Building. KLCC's Nathan Wilk, as always, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Why don't you remind folks first about why there was a fence erected at the Eugene Federal Building?
Right. So the General Services Administration, which is part of the federal government, put that fence up in April. And that came a few months after a January 30th protest at the Eugene Federal Building was declared a riot by Eugene police. Some windows were broken during that event. And so in the time after the General Services Administration said that, you know, securing the building, making sure its employees were safe, having time to kind of make repairs and fortify the building was part of putting that fencing up. It also came out during these hearings that there had been discussion previous to that event just because of some of the protest activity that's been happening there far longer under the Trump administration.
And so the story doesn't end there because plaintiffs brought suit saying that they felt that the fence was illegal. Take it from there.
Right. Because the fence blocked off both the parts of the sidewalk, but also the upper courtyard of the Eugene Federal Building. So during the hearing, you know, witnesses talked about how this was a historic site for protest, you know, that there had been protests against the invasion of Iraq, mm-hmm. and that, you know, essentially when events got large there, you know, having that extra space was very important. There was also discussion about access. Older protesters, you know, relied on having access to benches and shade, places to sit down during long protests, and also the fence cut off a ramp that provided some disability access. So ultimately, you know, protesters were arguing this fence, where it's placed, is infringing on our free speech rights.
Okay. And then the federal judge here in town weighed in on this. Talk about the most recent ruling.
Right. So he has issued a preliminary injunction, which means the trial will still go on, or rather the legal discussion. But, you know, that the plaintiffs showed merits that they are likely to succeed in their case. And what he discussed is really feeling like the federal government has an interest in protecting its property, but this is really, you know, too broad. It's of a solution, and it cuts off that traditional public forum of the upper space. And so ultimately what he decided to do is to call for, within 48 hours, the federal government needs to take that fence down. Now, initially during the hearing, he really wanted to move it, move the fence. He drafted up a sketch that sort of placed that fencing up closer against the building, so it left much of that upper area open to the public. But when the federal government's lawyers couldn't really give him a timeline on when that would happen, he said, okay, take what I've given you as guidance about where you could, you know, conceivably maybe put up a fence again in the future, but you need to bring this down now because the First Amendment can't wait for, you know, the contracts of moving the fence to be negotiated.
Nathan, you've been to that courthouse a lot covering protests. What are some of the people saying about this at least temporary removal of the fence?
Well, you know, the one of the plaintiffs I spoke to and many of the community members, they're very happy. You know, they felt like this was a, you know, attempt to kind of silence their free speech.
He's Nathan Wilk, reporter for us here at KLCC. Nathan, always appreciate your insight. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Michael.
That's the show for today. All episodes of Oregon on the Record are available as a podcast at klcc.org. Tomorrow on the show, you'll hear from a Guardian reporter about an explosive story of hidden rental fees that are drowning tenants throughout the U.S. and here in Oregon. I'm Michael Dunn, host of Oregon on the Record. Thanks for listening.